On RN Summer, this is The Final Cut, Jason DeRosso with you. And this is the first in a series of my favourite interviews with filmmakers from the last 12 months. Before we kick off, though, if you're looking for reviews of all the current holiday movies, you can download or stream The Final Cut's Summer Movie Critics Panel, in which we talk about the biggest and the best of the season, including films like Jackie and La La Land. But today is all about filmmakers talking film. And in a moment, you'll meet Michael Rowe, the boy from Ballarat, who started making films after he migrated to Mexico and has most recently made one in Quebec called Early Winter. It was my favourite new Australian directed film of the past year. Before him, though, to Bill Mechanic, the producer of Hacksaw Ridge, Mel Gibson's gritty, violent film about the battle for Okinawa in World War II, and a pacifist stretcher bearer by the name of Desmond Doss, played by Andrew Garfield, who became a war hero. The film swept the Australian Industry Awards, the Actors, where it won Best Film, Best Direction, and Best Lead Actor. But Bill Mechanic has other strings to his bow as well, including a history as the boss of Rupert Murdoch's Hollywood studio Fox when he greenlit Titanic. As you'll hear, working for Murdoch was not an easy experience for Bill.
It was a torturous relationship.
But we begin the conversation talking about Mel Gibson's film. Were there autobiographical elements in Mel's bloody and violent story of redemption in Hacksaw Ridge?
Yes and no. I mean, I think there is because he directed it and inhabited the picture, but the all that was written. So the truth is, because some of the reviews are saying it's almost, the advance reviews are almost like it's Mel concocted the movie as something for himself, but it's actually, you know, this is a 14-year-old project, and Mel passed in 2002 and 2010 to me. He's the only director I think I've ever offered the same movie to three times. And I always thought it was like, it was the perfect fit, intersection of Mel. You know, we did Braveheart 23 years ago. So, you know, William Wallace and Desmond Doss to me are the same character in essence, even if they're radically different. One's violent, one's nonviolent, but they're both men of conviction who are prepared to die for what they believe in. So I used to pitch it as a different form of Braveheart. So I went to Mel, and then you have the religious underpinning or the faith-based underpinning, because we're not very religious in the picture. And I thought Mel would understand that better than anybody else. And the more real that is, then the better the movie is. But I think he never read it. I think it was his people who read it and always said they love it, and we never got anywhere. You know, there were other people who were attached, and I'd sold it to a company that I thought would protect the religious nature of the film, that it wouldn't be anything more than it is or anything less than it was. It just is who the character is and nothing more than that. And I finally had a director who I liked, and I cut the budget in half to get it so that they would make it. And all of a sudden, then it has to be a PG-13. And I went, but it's the bloodiest battle of the Pacific. Of the only Stalingrad, more people died. There's 300,000 people lost their lives, most of them Okinawans, but still, you know, extraordinary death toll. And he's a medic. So there's no way to have somebody not see what the impact of that is on the character.
And it's a very, I mean, we see a lot in the film, you know.
You have to. And so I forced it out of the company by getting Mel onto the picture finally. And it's not going to be a PG-13. It doesn't want to be a PG-13. And they finally, after 8 years, gave it back to me, or let me buy it back.
Were you one of the few people offering Mel a directing gig at this time? I mean,
I'm sure there's, to a certain degree, there was his persona non grata, because nobody wanted to distribute the movie. Even people who I had when I did Braveheart with him that I put on the road with Mel, and you know, everybody was sort of afraid, but I don't really know and I don't really care. I'm not concerned what other people want.
I mean, we're talking about, of course, you know, the
studios.
But we're talking about the controversies that surrounded Mel.
The noise, as you were. You know, and again, it's 10 years. He was drunk. You know, it's not a good thing. I'm not condoning what he said or what he did, and nor would I condone any kind of negative act. But at some point, there is either forgiveness or you're not human. And in fact, one of the, I think, big themes, and when I talked to Mel about it, the big themes in the movie, and I had to cut into the ending of the picture, is Captain Glover, who is one of Desmond's persecutors, the captain.
Yeah, at boot camp.
He saves him.
Yeah.
And 53 years later, when that interview was recorded, you can see Glover tearing up as he's still asking for forgiveness from Desmond. So to me, it's a story. It's got a lot of different themes in it, but one of those themes is bullying and forgiveness.
This is a film that cost around $45 million to make.
Yeah, slightly less, but okay. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's an interesting section of the market. You'll know better than me. Mm-hmm. Of the industry, sorry, yeah. Because, you know, people have been talking for a lot of years now about the hollowing out of that middle ground. You know, you either make, especially in Hollywood, you either make $200 million pictures or, you know, pictures above $100 million, or you're making no budget pictures. Right. That $30 million, $40
million. $50 million, $60 million, they're gone. They're the middle class, as I say, is sort of like going to Rio and you're in a penthouse on one side of the street, you're in a bodega on the other side of the street, you're in the slums. So Hollywood has, and again, hollowing out is a good term for it. But when I was running Fox, particularly, those were the pictures that I was making. The Fight Clubs, the Braveheart was $70 million. But even the first X-Men was $67 million. Mm. And Something About Mary was $30 million. And Ice Age was $60 million.
Yeah, so, great film.
So those are all pictures that were made in the middle ground.
The Ice Storm, you mean? Or Ice Age?
Ice Storm and Ice Age. Okay. I did too. I did them both. Ice Storm was less expensive. Pretty Ang austere
film.
Movie.
Great film though.
Yes, yeah. Ang Lee's one of Ang Lee's best films. We did The Beach, which is in that range. And, you know, you just go through them. They're almost all sort of in the, they weren't, you know, other than Titanic, which wasn't meant to be as big as it was. And Castaway, which wasn't meant to be as big as it was, they're almost all in that middle ground.
So, what does that mean? That hollowing out of that ground now. What does that mean for pictures like Hacksaw Ridge or?
It makes you extinct. You're a dinosaur. Nobody wants to make them. They're close to impossible. Close to impossible to make. As a reason why it took me 14 years to make this movie.
But you're making it now. Why?
Well, in the end, you know, one had to cut the budget. So Braveheart is 50% more expensive than Hacksaw Ridge, which there's no bullets, there's no bombs, there's no planes, there's no ships. You know, so technically, Braveheart's a much easier movie to make, and you're making it for half the budget 20 years later. So that's insane by itself. But also, you know, you just have to find a way to finance it. So the fact that this movie was made in Australia would not have been made. I mean, we didn't come here originally for that reason. We came for the escarpment, you know, and that was 2002. It was one place to find it. And I thought once I got Mel that, let me see if I can, because I'd made two pictures here, could I raise the money out of Australian financing, you know, Screen Australia supported us, even though we're kind of an odd choice and, you know, I'm American, Mel's technically American. But, you know, other than six people or seven people, it's all Australian. So that piece of money became the foundation of me getting the picture made.
I want to ask you a question based on a quote I read this week, but it's a few years old now, a couple of years old. Hawk Koch,
right.
Who mm-hmm. is a colleague of yours, you mm-hmm. know, a renowned producer in Hollywood, he commented a couple of years ago that studios were no longer, I mean, people were no longer greenlighting films on gut instinct. They were greenlighting them via committee. Is that part of?
I don't think it's by committee. No, I think that's a misnomer. I mean, I actually did the first greenlight committees, which I had all the different departments of the studio read the scripts because I wanted people more involved and voice their opinions. You know, a lot of it was negative, you know, that won't work in my market. Mm. You know, this is not that. Not to let it rule, but to understand what the negatives were. And did I think about something that I should have thought about? So I thought it was very valuable. And then you do what you're going to do.
He didn't say that about you, by the way.
I'm saying, and now it's become there are committees, but mostly it's not that. Mostly it's that the people who are running a studios are trying to just hit home runs because that's what the companies that own the studios want. They don't care about movies. I mean, there's zero, they don't care if the movies go away. I think if you read what James Murdoch said 2 weeks ago, which is nobody wants, you know, you should get out of the window business. You should be, movies should be released simultaneously at the home because people don't want to go to theaters. That's him. That's not the people.
Mm.
And this movie, particularly like A Hacksaw Ridge, is meant to be experiential. You know, we mix the sound specially. So when you're in a battlefield, the battle, you're surrounded by bullets and bombs. And, you know, so we're the immersion into the story, you know, which is a drama here, but it's funny and it's sad and it's harrowing. But it could work. It's just as important in a comedy. It's just as important in a horror film. You know, that's what movies to me are made of. They're not just made as accoutrements, you know, that they're meant to be pretty and big and silly and, you know, it's all digital. So, you know, which comes back to the why Mel, because Braveheart, Apocalypto, Passion of the Christ are shot practically. So I'm personally sick of watching digital armies battle digital armies where, you know, there's no reality to it. You know, and when you watch this movie, good or bad, you're going to feel like you're sitting in the middle of something and you're Desmond Doss or you're that soldier. And holy Toledo, war is, as it should be, presented, and it probably never has, as hell.
You greenlit the first X-Men.
Yeah.
All these years later. I mean, I don't have to tell you about the complaints people have about comic book movies and where that's headed. Do you ever regret letting that genie out of the bottle?
Well, I got fired the week that X-Men opened because they, you know, my bosses, Murdoch and Ternan, were like, I made a they called it my $70 million art film. Like, who wants to see a comic book movie? But we started in a concentration camp, so it was meant to be about alienation. And now it's a tyranny. You know, I had Hugh Jackman who had never been in a movie, and, you know, I grew up on comic books. Actually, as I've told the story, I collected comic books. So when I paid for my grad school, film school, I sold my Marvel collection to pay for school and then bought all the rights when I was at Fox, and they let them all go, but except for X-Men and Fantastic Four, which they kind of butchered. But do I think it's a tyranny now? I think Marvel's done an amazing job. So better job than I would have ever done. Truthfully, I think they're a first-rate film company. But I bought all those rights so that I wouldn't have a plethora of those pictures out there. I wanted a controlled environment. And right now I feel like between what they're doing and what now, you know, the competition is doing it's eliminating choice. And at some point, I think it's a problem. Again, I'm a target film goer for that, even though I'm older than that target audience, and I've stopped going.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I think there's a problem.
How much did the Murdochs ever sort of have control over Fox when you were there? I mean, did Rupert ever get on the phone and say, what are you doing?
Oh, yes. There were a few times. When I did Titanic, he was both great and terrible at the same time. He never told me, just chop the movie off, stop it, you know, but would ride me mercilessly of how stupid it was and all that. And so the first time I showed the movie was in Minnesota. It was 3 hours and 49 minutes long at that time, which is 40 minutes longer than it was. And we flew back, and Jim and I on the plane, we'd agreed on what the cuts were. And so I said, fine, great, we're done. And I called Murdoch and said, do you want to see your movie? Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, and then 2 minutes later, Peter Turner runs in my office and is like, did you just ask Murdoch to see the movie? And I go, it's, you know, cause it's 3 hours, 40 minutes. And it's like, yeah, yeah. I said, it's the only time you'll see all his movie on the screen. So the next night they set up the screening, but it was so long, that the film, and it was days of film. So it was spliced, and the splices kept breaking. So they had to shut the movie down. So Tom Sherrick, who was, bless his soul, who's, was my head of distribution, called Sony, which is the closest studio to Fox. And, got what movie you have. So the next movie out was Air Force One. So they screened Air Force One the next night with heavy splices. They then screened Titanic for Murdoch, and he calls me, which again, rare that I called him and he called me, and goes, "So I saw your movie last night, and I understand it's good, but it's no Air Force One." And I thought, if it was Air Force One, you would just lost $200 million.
And did he ring you up again after all the receipts were in for Titanic?
No, never congratulated me, never said thank you, never said you were right. You know, it's just the way of the world. He thought when I made Fight Club, he called it, you said to me, you have to be sick to make that movie. And then when we did Something About Mary and Something Else and Something Else and Something Else, it all worked. He said, I guess you got lucky. So it was a torturous relationship, but that's okay. Everybody goes their own way.
Hacksaw Ridge producer Bill Mechanic. On RN Summer, this is The Final Cut. I'm Jason DeRosso, playing you highlights of the year's filmmaker conversations. Hacksaw Ridge might have won big this year at Australia's Industry Awards, The Actors, but I think this next filmmaker should have got a look in too. He's Michael Rowe, a man who's been making films in Mexico for the past few years. His first film, Leap Year, won the Best First Feature Prize at Cannes in 2010, a year after Warwick Thornton won the same prize for Samson and Delilah. Michael Rowe's most recent film, Early Winter, is shot in Canada. It's the story of an Anglophone couple living in Quebec. He's Canadian and works night shifts in a nursing home. She's originally from Eastern Europe. And they're both navigating the banality and chaos of family life with two small sons. In Australia, we don't tend to produce directors interested in making bold statements formally, but this is quite an exception. Visually, Early Winter is striking for its use of long shots that don't have camera movement and avoid close-ups, resulting in a film that makes you feel a little bit like a voyeur looking into a cage. The movement, the tension, happens within the frame. And mostly, that's enough. Xavier Dolan, regular Suzanne Clement, and Paul Doucet are excellent in the lead roles. And if it all sounds a little bit bleak for something you'd want to watch over the holiday season, I think the film's strength is that it navigates a middle path between despair and a trite happy ending. Here's Michael Rowe talking on Skype.
This is a film that deals with solitude and human isolation. And I try and reflect through the camera this theme. And I feel like having a fairly open shot, a still camera, isolates the character and limits our, as an audience, our ability to empathize with him. At the same time, it gives us a certain voyeuristic fly-on-the-wall interest in what's going on. And yeah, there's also, I have personal reasons for doing it. Aesthetic reasons and artistic reasons. I don't believe in manipulating the response of an audience. I think that if the script is strong enough and if the acting's good enough, the audience should feel the emotions without me needing to manipulate their response through a close-up or a dolly in or a dolly out or whatever. I also feel like it's a question of respect for the actors, because in Hollywood and indeed in all conventional films, there is so much of the performance that's constructed later in the editing room, and you can completely change the semantics and the work of the actor in the edit. And I don't believe in that. I work very closely with actors, and I see them as my co-creators. I have an enormous respect for their work, and for them, I think it's an unusual opportunity that they really enjoy to actually act and be able to take an emotional curve from beginning to end during a single scene.
Tell me about the intruders into frame that you've carefully choreographed from time to time that aren't human. We have these elements of wildlife, I suppose you could call them, that unexpectedly enter into our line of sight in this film. What was that about?
Once again, this is a film about isolation, and one of the major reasons that we humans feel isolated is because we close our eyes and our emotions to the world around us. And on a larger scale, that includes the lives that are present all the time and every moment around us and that we don't see, which are the non-human lives. The average person will see in one day their dog or the neighbor's dog or a cat And that's about it. But there are hundreds of other lives that live in the same building as us that we don't see. We choose not to see. Spiders, mice, possums. And I think that it's very difficult to feel isolated or depressed when you deeply understand that we are just part of an enormous number of billions of individual life forms on our city block. And to realize that you're not alone in the world, it's as easy as looking at the spider and the fly on the wall.
Well, it's also true, I think, that there's been research done on the effects that the pets have in the lives of people suffering depression, and that research seems to suggest that the companionship of animals is something beneficial. But of course, I don't want to suggest to the listener that your film has any kind of Lassie vibe in it. It's not about pets. There is something much more cosmic and slightly deliciously random about your inclusion of animals in the film, and I'll leave that for people to discover when they go and see it. But I'd like to turn this discussion now to your career so far and the fact that in your early 20s, after studying literature at La Trobe, you went off to Mexico. And so I'd like to understand what you think the difference between Mexico and Australia is that meant that you had a film career there and are having a film career there. This film, of course, is shot in Montreal, but, you know, essentially Mexico is the country that launched you and not Australia.
I think that chaos is kind of the key a little bit. And the thing with Mexico is that things are a little bit chaotic, but within that chaos, there are opportunities if you know how to take advantage of them. So I studied screenwriting. First I learned Spanish, then studied screenwriting, and walked around with a fairly dog-eared or an increasingly dog-eared copy of my script under my arm for about 8 years. Knocking on doors, and when I finally realized that nobody was going to make my film if I didn't direct it myself, I wrote a script for two people in a room and was able to get privately funded money together to do the film, which became Leap Year. I think there's a great reliance in Australia on government funding, and structurally the industry is very much dominated by funding agencies and by the fear of directors of those funding agencies. And what I've found here is that there is an enormous will to please on the part of aspiring directors. And they, instead of starting out with a story that's important to them, they start out trying to second guess what some development funding person is going to think is a good idea this week. And to be honest, the only people who know, or not the only people, but really the most of the people who know how to make films are making films. There are a few critics out there who also know, but a lot of the people in government agencies are bureaucrats, and they're very good bureaucrats, but that doesn't necessarily make them filmmakers, and they don't understand, you know. So they're trying to get the copy of the copy of something that was successful in the United States 15 years ago. And that's just a recipe for mediocrity.
Director Michael Rowe talking about his film Early Winter, a highlight of the past year. You've been listening to an RN summer edition of the show. I'm Jason DeRosso. If you're interested in hearing about the films releasing over this holiday season, do check out the Final Cut's Summer Movies panel online for reviews of the biggest and the best. See you next week for more filmmaker interview highlights from the last 12 months. You'll hear from the British veteran director, Terence Davies, who gets pretty deep reflecting on mortality and the meaning of life.
I do see that the glass is half empty and not half full. My view of the human condition is essentially tragic. I think we endure and have to endure in the face of death without becoming bitter, you know, or corroded. But that's not a comfort, you know, and a lot of people don't like it, and quite right too. If they don't like it, they don't like my work. I'm definitely an acquired taste, you know. I am not by any means popular. But I don't believe in false hope. I think that's a complete betrayal.
You'll also hear from the Colombian director Ciro Guerra, whose first film, Embrace of the Serpent, was one of my highlights from the year. Look forward to your company then.